Session number 12350, Flying Officer A.S. Anderson, Reel 1.
Flying Officer Anderson, Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born?
Well, of course I was there at the time. I don't recall much about it. It was Oswestry, Street, Shropshire. And the 4th of May, 1917. Which makes me now in my 75th year.
And what did your father do?
He was in advertising. He had rather a peculiar career because he was a boy at school at Bedford College, and having been born in the Argentine, he left his father and mother there and come to England to complete his education. And when he was about 16, his father died, and there, of course, was a sort of hang-up, as there always is when a will is being probated. And when it's being probated between the Argentina and England, then it's a doubly complicated and lengthy process. And he was left with no money to pay his fees at school. So he took a job as a clerk in a coal merchant's office. And he earned enough money to get back to the Argentine, and he never let on that he spoke Spanish. He looked like an Englishman born and spoke like an Englishman born. And he got a job in an advertising agency, and of course the people working there didn't know that he spoke Spanish. And he understood every word everybody was saying, and he soon rumbled the fact that the fellow who was running the office for the owner was putting the profits into his own pocket. And he got a bit tired of that, so he went to the owner and told him, and the owner looked into it and found out it was so, and he made my father a partner. And at the age of 26, my father bought him out. And so, anyway, that's the Argentine. But the connection is longer than that with the Air Force, because my cousin Pip, he was flying with the Royal Flying Corps in 1917. So my connection with the Air Force, though indirect, was quite long-standing.
And did you know him?
Nope, never met him. I only saw photographs. You know. Right. I've got lots of cousins in the Argentine to this day that I've never met.
Now, where were you educated?
First of all, in a small prep school at Farnham, near Farnham, a place called, it's on the road to Hindhead from Farnham anyway.
Yes.
It was called Melbrack. I don't suppose it's there anymore. Then I was at a prep school called Pinewood in South Farnborough in Hampshire. And then I was at Stowe. And from Stowe, I went to train as a commercial pilot at Air Service Training in Hamble and Southampton.
At what age did you leave Stowe?
I think 17. I think 1935, anyway. People who can add and subtract can work that out.
Right.
The one thing I cannot do is play around with ciphers. Absolutely useless at it.
Did you have a clear idea when you left school of what you wanted to do?
Well, not really, no. My father left me independent. I had two elder sisters, and my mother was widowed when I was 7 years of age. But my father was also a great cricketer, and that's why she was widowed, because his brother, J.O. Anderson, I think he's in Wisdoms, was the first man, as so I've heard, I've never checked it, to take an MCC touring team overseas. and he played Buenos Aires with the team he brought with him, and my father was in the outfield on a day which was overcast but gave him sunstroke. That's why he left the Argentina and came back to England and was introduced to my mother by a man who in his day was a very celebrated orthopedic surgeon, Gaythorne Girdleston. In the 30s he ran the Wingfield Morris Hospital in Oxford. Now it's another name, Nuffield School or something or other. I don't remember. I haven't been back there since I was in hospital there in 1943.
Do you remember why you decided you'd like to become a pilot?
Well, I'd been mad about aircraft ever since I was a little boy. And South Farnborough, of course, was the aerodrome where they tried out all the prototypes. So I have, I would say, an almost unique experience of the development of heavier than aircraft in the 20s and 30s. Because I went there in about, let me see, about 1926. And I left there in 1930. So I saw things like the first tailless aircraft, the Western Hill Pterodactyl, the first fighter bomber, the Bolton and Paul Overstrand and Sidestrand, and the precursors of the fighter aircraft of the Second World War, things like the Bristol Bulldog, Hawker Tomtit, and really all the experimental fighters that they had in the 20s. And I was very familiar with the sound of engines being tested to destruction. As you probably know, Farnborough is one of two places in England where there's an airship hangar. Laffan's plane, of course, it was originally. And I saw the original autogyro, which had the body of a 504K Avro and four rotors with wire connections between the base of the rotating centre. With the four rotors, the outer part was the lifting surface, and there was a sort of stalk about 4 feet long, which was connected to the rotor, and at the point where the stalk joined the lifting surface, there was a point of attachment of a wire in the center of which, that is to say, halfway through the angle between the two blades, the four blades, there'd be a weight to give centrifugal pull to keep the lifting surfaces rigid. And I remember seeing an aircraft with two people in it coming in one day, and the point of attachment on one of the blades had come loose, and they were being shaken forward and back like that, and they were coming in like a bat out of hell because they had extra need to have extra lift, risk the smack in the end just to keep airborne. And they made it all right. They had some remarkable pilots.
They didn't crash?
No, they didn't.
Did you get to know people around the airfields then?
No, just a little boy. Sometimes we'd go for walks and we'd see them in the distance, but I didn't meet any of them. Mm-hmm. I met some of them later, like the De Havillands, because they were at the same school as I was.
When you left Stowe, how did you actually go about becoming a commercial pilot?
I never did. I went to the University of Grenoble for a couple of years. My knowledge, that's pretentious.
What did you study?
It was just humanities. And, of course, having wandered around Central Europe when I was at school there, like everybody else who lived there, we knew what was going to happen. Nobody in England knew, of course, they having their weekends as usual. It was perfectly obvious that Hitler was going to start something pretty bad. And my friend, Christopher Law, brilliant artist. He's had a house called Levers in Hadlow, Kent. And his girlfriend was the daughter of a leading banker in Prague. And he got her out of there on the last train to leave the city before the Nazis could step in. So we, kids, you know, 19,
yes.
We knew what was going to happen. We didn't, perhaps, take life so seriously because we expected to get killed, quite frankly. And you say it'll never happen to me, but in the back of your mind, you know damn well if there's going to be a war, you've got as good a chance of being ripped off as anybody else. But when Chamberlain came back from Munich, I volunteered. Donald Banks was then the Secretary of State for Air, and I volunteered my services in the event of there being a war, which, as I say, everybody who'd been in Central Europe at that time knew. And I still have it. I meant to get the papers out this morning, but unfortunately I can't find the darn attaché case. But I will find it and give the papers to you later. But I have the letter from him, of course it's a mimeograph, in 1938, thanking me for the offer of my services and pointing out that I could join the RAF and all that stuff.
So what did you do then?
Well, I just sat tight till the war came. I got married. That was quite important to me. I said to my then fiancé, I said, this is going to happen. Yeah. We've got to face it. Somebody's got to do the dirty work, and it's fallen to our generation to get on with it. And I'd been getting German Jews out of Germany into Switzerland. So I was in Zurich a while just before the war. They had what they call a Landesausstellung, exhibition of the country, yeah. I suppose you'd call it. And I met some people, very interesting people there, who were busy with this particular... It was a Roman Catholic organization getting the Jews out. And I don't happen to belong to either sect or religion. But it seemed to me that this was the thing to do. And so I got mixed up with the people who had organized getting German Jewish refugees out.
What did you do to help refugees?
Well, I didn't really do very much. I helped keep the books, so to speak, and I went along one to keep it in. Can you play over the last... I hate being interrupted like this. It shatters my change of thought. It's not important anyway. I didn't do anything really important.
So had you gone about seeking...
No, I was just staying in the house of the people when I had the intention of going to the university in Zurich for a little while. And then I thought, no, it's... not with it was just so little time obviously available before the war. I don't want to spend it all going to school.
Had you inquired as to how to become how to train as a pilot by this time?
I had already done it. You see, when I left school, I went straight to air service training, and that was a 2-year thing. And then,
what did that involve?
Well, you trained on all the current aircraft of the day. We had a thing called the Saunders Roe Cutty Sark, which was an underpowered twin-motored flying boat with retractable undercarriage. And the Avro 504K and the Avro Cadet and Avro Tutor.
Where did you do this training?
Air Service Training, Hamble, Southampton. It's now moved, I think, to Scotland or somewhere. But it was the biggest air service, what its name implies,
yes.
Air service training.
And did you do this before going to university in Grenoble? Or?
Yes, before. When I left school, I was...
Right. And did this training actually involve flying?
Oh, yes. My flying instructor was Lord Malcolm Douglas Hamilton. He was a flying officer in the RAF and VR. And we had a lot of service people who were our instructors. Flight Lieutenant Barling, Flight Lieutenant Walker, and Flight Lieutenant Pascoe, Flight Lieutenant Middleton, and Group Captain Barton, who retired from the service to take over the running of the school, was the, well, the head man there. I never knew why, but he had the nickname was Fanny. Very odd. Anyway, I did 2 years with that, and as I say, I was independent, and I didn't have to take a job if I didn't want to. That's when I went on to Grenoble to better my French. And I have an odd connection with France because an ancestor of mine, Jacques Boileau, was a Comte de Castelnau et de Sainte-Croix, which are two villages in the sort of Bas-Pyrénées area, sort of southeast of Bordeaux somewhere. I've never been there, I'm ashamed to say. But he was a Huguenot. And when the King Francis repealed the Edict of Nantes, I think 1572 it was, he was, of course, in danger of his life. And he was too much liked to be put to the knife, so they left him to die of starvation in prison, while his son put his running shoes on, went over the border into Holland and then into England. And he married into the Distaff side of my family. And on my father's mother, that's right, she was a Hughes. And so technically, I suppose I'm the Comte de Castelnau de Sainte-Croix because I'm the oldest surviving male.
Right.
Doesn't bring any money with it, unfortunately.
So in 1938, this was when you came back from university?
Well, I was to and fro, but you know, one goes on holiday and then.
And you, so you were obviously keen to get on and join me.
Well, I knew I had to go. All my wife's family were, not sure whether it was Royal Horse or Royal Field Artillery at that time, but they'd been seconded to the Indian Army, and she had three brothers actually, one died in India, and they were all born there. She was born when my mother was on leave in England. Yeah, she, being an army wife, so to speak, she understood when the job has to be done, somebody's got to go and do it. And I said to her, we were married on the 7th of June, 39, and I said to her, I'm afraid I have to ask you to let me go. And she was very brave about it. She said, you know, I might go. And so I was in uniform 13 days after the war was officially declared, having volunteered before, and reported for duty, you see.
Yes.
The day after it was declared.
You were, where did you go to do that?
Adgate. Oh, I was in Reading.
Right.
But my reception depot was Padgate. And I enjoyed my time there, really. You met an amazing cross-section of volunteers. One of them is now a master of the Inner Temple in London. His name was Stranger Jones. And there was another Irish gentleman, Paddy Dudley.
What happened while you were at Padgate?
You know, they put you through a certain amount of physical exercise and taught you to call the corporal sir and useful information like that. And then you were sorted out according to what they had decided you could do, and you were sent to a training center. And I, some clever clerical gentleman had read my dossier and decided that because I spoke several foreign languages, I'd probably be a good police corporal, so they made me a police corporal. I went to Uxbridge Police School there.
How did you feel about that?
Job to be done. I'd hope they'd give me an aeroplane and let me fly it, but no. So off I went to France in 1940 as an aircraft and first class acting corporal. And I was, I think, on my station number one, RSU, Repair and Salvage Unit, and Aminagdizi. It's on the road where the monument to the Anzacs of the First World War is. And during the whole time that we were there, we had no protection. I mean, it was a phony war. All we had was rifles. I mean, there wasn't even a machine gun on the station. Then as a repair and salvage unit, we were obviously not a prime target. We used to go around picking up the bits of aircraft that had crashed, and if there were any instruments or bits and pieces that could be reused.
Was there much to do at this time, in terms of repair and salvage?
Oh, well, no more than routine, because the war was not on. The shooting war wasn't on. Until the 28th of May. And then started with a vengeance with us. We were bombed out. Our squadron leader White, I don't know what the hell he did in peacetime, but his adjutant, Reese, was an inspector of taxis in Southampton. And in my part of the business was the police, of course. We were told that we had to leave at 5 o'clock after the bombardment had started. And half the unit went off in the morning, and the rest of us went off at 5 o'clock. And we got to a place called Yvetot, Y-V-E-T-O-T, which makes beautiful mustard, by the way. It sells a lot to this country. And we spent the night there in a disused cinema. And we were very lucky. We went strafed on the road, but we were bombed and machine gunned when we were on the station, of course. The Germans did it quite thoroughly. They didn't harm the runway because they were going to use it themselves. So they bombed us around it. And a lot of very heroic stuff went on among people like my armourer sergeant. He was going around digging up bombs and defusing them, the ones that didn't go off at once. And nobody, of course, gave him any credit for that. The unit was broken up when we got back to England.
How did you actually get back to England?
Well, to start with, I got on the back of a fire tender, Crosley fire tender, and I had a friend there who had been in the police with me, and Frank Stanford, a fellow from Birmingham. And we went, as far as Yvetot the first night. And we got out of there and we headed for Le Havre. But Le Havre was mined up, and we couldn't get out of there, even if there'd been ships, which there weren't. So our current orders were to go south and get out through Cherbourg. So we did. We went south the next day. This was the third day after the bombing in Amiens. And we went across the mouth of the Seine at a place called Kielbeuf, where there was a floating bridge ferry. Poor devils working day and night. Four rows of traffic all coming south from the Netherlands and North France to get away from the Germans. And Napoleon actually opened that, I think, in 1813 or something. But anyway, we got across and went up the Cherbourg Peninsula via Caen and Isigny. And I remember all the apple orchards being in blossom. We thank God had good weather. Well, it was the beginning of May. And we got to Cherbourg and spent the night there in our truck, lorry, whatever. And we left on a channel packet early the next morning. And as luck would have it, for me, we went to Southampton, and my wife was living there at the time. So...
Was it an uneventful...
We were very lucky. There was so much going on to the north that we were not molested in any way. Because if we'd been molested, we probably wouldn't have been here now, so to speak. They did quite a good job when they were attacked.
So you returned to England, and what did you do next?
I was posted to number one officer's training unit, not to be trained as an officer, but to do my job as a policeman on the gate. I had previously missed two recommendations for a commission because in England, as you probably know, if you're recommended for a commission by the commanding officer of your unit, you have to wait 3 months before your application is passed upon as suitable or unsuitable by Air Ministry, Admiralty, War Office, whatever. And through being posted elsewhere during the 3 months, I'd missed getting the commission twice. But the third time I was lucky. And I was on a court-martial charge on the day my commission came through.
Why was that?
But, I was in charge of guard, and we had two men called Smith. And I took over from my under-training man at 4 o'clock. I said, "Is everybody present and correct?" He was an intelligent young man, and he said, "Yes, they are." And I said, "All right." And I looked down the list, and all the names were ticked off. And I said, "Yeah, Smith's here, is he?" Because Smith was the Smith that I wanted was a real bad egg. He'd gone AWOL twice already, and he was guilty of all sorts of crimes, and he was on his sprees. And I wasn't feeling very well because I just had an injection of tetanus or something. You'd had to have these things, as you know, in service in regular intervals. And anyway, I should have checked to feel the body, and I didn't. I took the word man's word for it from whom I took over. But this particular Smith that was there on the list, and then I didn't know there was another Smith. And our boy had gone AWOL again, and it was 3 hours before I reported it, which didn't look too good. But anyway, I was very fortunate in that I had the medical officer to speak for me, and my previous record did me no harm, short as it was. And so I walked straight from being putative victim of a court-martial to being a pilot officer. Then I was posted to France. No, after I was back from France, of course, I was posted to Egypt. And but before that, I skipped a peg there. Before that, I was with... trying to get the squadrons in order.
Was this 242?
No, that was after. 242, yes. I was there briefly with Barter. Briefly. I didn't know at the time that he was the brother-in-law of my old school captain, Lucas. Didn't learn it, in fact, until I met Lanny himself again. He came to see me here in the hospital.
So you were with 242 Squadron at the same
briefly,
time?
Briefly, yes. I must digress to tell you a story about the intelligence officer there, a journalist, a rather charming, flamboyant character called Richmond. And he, being an enterprising fellow, had read King's Rules and Regulations from cover to cover to make certain that there was nothing in there that he could turn to his own personal advantage. And he discovered that there was no dictum on what colour the lining of an RAF officer's greatcoat should be. So he had his line in Schiaparelli, shocking pink. And he used to make a beautiful entrance, like some tropical night moth into night spots and places where you noticed a very remarkable combination of the shocking pink and the wide flung overcoat. So that's a digression. These are little things that you run into in the war that make things bearable.
Which was your first posting then?
When I was commissioned, it was, dear me,
I have down here 117 Squadron.
Well, that was after. I went from 242 to 117, which was Stanford Tuck's outfit. I never met him either. Never met him because he'd been taken prisoner just before. They were flying both fighters out of Debden, Saffron Walden, as these. And I was there for about 3 months, and then they posted me to Egypt.
During this brief spell with 242 Squadron, did you actually get to know Douglas Bader?
Not well. It wasn't, you know, getting to know people. If you fly with them, yes. If you don't, inevitably there is a difference. I don't mean to say that there was any snobbishness about the boys who had wings and the boys that didn't. Nothing like that at all.